Good evening. I'm William Brangham. Amna Nawaz and Jeff Bennett are away. On the NewsHour tonight, the United Auto Workers expands its strike to dozens more facilities, putting further pressure on the big three nationwide. Congress is mired in gridlock as a government shutdown draws nearer and Senate lawmakers try to work around a Republicans' blockade on military leadership. And Ukraine's national security advisor discusses the ongoing counteroffensive and the uncertain future of their fight against Russia.
But every day we're inching forward. What I mean is that, unfortunately, it is not only up to us when it comes to the fighting. A lot depends on other factors, which, unfortunately, we have no control over.
Welcome to the NewsHour. I'm William Brangham. On Capitol Hill today, a looming government shutdown, a top senator is indicted, and lawmakers find a way around a months-long block on military promotions. More on those developments in a moment. But first, the United Auto Workers expanded their strike against two of Detroit's big three auto manufacturers today. Workers at 38 more sites in 20 different states are now joining the picket line, all part of a move designed to get the attention of car buyers and car owners. Ali Rogan reports.
No pay!
No parts!
No pay!
No parts!
From GM facilities in Flint, Michigan, to Stellantis distribution centers in Dallas, Texas, auto workers have taken their walkouts nationwide following the union's latest rallying cry.
Today, at noon Eastern time, all of the parts distribution facilities at General Motors and Stellantis are being called to stand up and strike.
UAW President Sean Fain called on an additional 5,600 auto workers to join the 13,000 already on strike against the Detroit Big Three manufacturers. UAW is now targeting GM and Stellantis and their parts distribution facilities for dealerships, but it spared Ford from any additional work stoppages for now. Fain said the union made, quote, real progress with Ford this week on cost of living adjustments, profit sharing, and job security. But a deal is far from done.
We still have serious issues to work through, but we do want to recognize that Ford is showing that they're serious about reaching a deal. At GM and Stellantis, it's a different story.
Those two automakers fell short on cost of living allowances, providing zero increases over a four-year term. They also rejected the union's profit-sharing and job security proposals, as well as changes that would convert temps into permanent positions. UAW has other demands for all three companies, most notably wage hikes of 36% over 4 years. So far, the carmakers have put forward little more than half that, about 20% across the board. The union has also proposed other significant changes, a four-day work week and traditional pension plans, and the end of tiered wages, all aimed at getting back some of what workers lost during the 2008 financial crisis. The automakers argue they cannot meet many of the union's demands, largely due to the industry's expensive shift to electric vehicles. Earlier this week, Detroit Free Press published an op-ed by GM President Mark Roos, writing, quote, 85% of current represented employees would earn a base wage of approximately $82,000. The UAW's demands can be described in one word, untenable. Late today, the White House announced President Biden will travel to Michigan on Tuesday after the union dialed up the pressure by inviting him to the picket lines. While the president has expressed support for the workers, he has steered clear of getting too involved, including in the negotiations. Just one day later, former President Donald Trump is also expected to meet with union workers instead of attending the second presidential debate. The former president is trying to peel off union workers to support him. For its part, the union leadership has said a second Trump presidency would be a disaster. In the meantime, UAW says consumers will feel the impact of this strike expansion as the attention turns from production plants to distribution centers. Workers say they're prepared for a lasting standoff.
We'll take as long as we have to. If they're willing to come back and negotiate, we'll be ready at any time.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Ali Rogan.
Turning from the auto industry to the U.S. Capitol, it has been an unusual headline-making day with a series of developments, including news this morning that New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez, a Democrat and powerful committee chairman, has been indicted on bribery charges. Our congressional correspondent, Lisa Desjardins, is covering that and more, and she joins us now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
This is such a striking indictment against Senator Menendez. Can you help us understand what the accusations are?
Not just against him, but also with his wife. There are three counts here. They are all bribery charges, essentially. Charging that Menendez and his wife, in a relationship with three businessmen they knew, took bribes, including money, and we'll get into other things in a minute, in order to help, in some cases, deal with potential prosecutions of those businessmen and also foreign governments. Here's what the prosecutor of this district in New York said today about the case.
The indictment alleges that through that relationship, the senator and his wife accepted hundreds of thousands of dollars of bribes in exchange for Senator Menendez using his power and influence to protect and to enrich those businessmen and to benefit the government of Egypt.
Menendez has fired back today in a lengthy statement, said that this is a smear campaign against him. Here's some of what he wrote. He said, prosecutors have misrepresented the normal work of a congressional office. On top of that, not content with making false claims against me, they've attacked my wife for longstanding friendships she had before she ever met me. Let's go through some of the details in that indictment, though, because it came also with photos that were significant. Prosecutors alleged that found at Menendez's home was nothing less than almost $500,000 in cash and gold bars. In some cases, I think two large gold bars, over $100,000 worth. They said the DNA of one of the businessmen who is accused in this case was found on envelopes with that cash in hand. Now, this is the third investigation that we know of in Senator Menendez's career. The last one in 2015 ended in a hung jury. He was not convicted. He kept his job in the Senate, as you know. But now tonight, the New Jersey governor, Phil Murphy, a Democrat, is calling for Mr. Menendez to resign. He has, because of Senate rules for Democrats, stepped down from his chairmanship.
Really striking, striking development. Another major setback here that I know you are following is a major setback in the efforts to fund the government. Mm-hmm. Speaker McCarthy basically let all of Congress go home for the long weekend, even as we are on the precipice of a shutdown. What is happening on that front?
Much more to say, but here's going into the weekend what I want folks to know. Essentially, House Republicans now have given themselves not just a week because they've gone home, but the 4 days that they come back. They'll come back next Tuesday and Wednesday to try and figure this whole mess out. They were not able to figure out a short-term funding deal that all the Republicans could agree to. So instead, what are they doing? They're trying to recreate the entire appropriations process from scratch, working on the 11 different appropriations bills that are due. That is something that takes weeks and weeks, yet that is what House Republicans are trying to do in an effort to try and get a more conservative spending bill in negotiations down the road with the Senate. It's quite a wild idea. It's something we've never seen at this point in the process before. So a lot of folks are saying, all right, the shutdown's coming next week. Why not just agree with some Democrats on a clean, easy, short-term deal? Speaker McCarthy was asked about that today. How about working with Democrats?
I believe we have a majority here, and we can work together to solve this. This is the same place you were all asking me during the debt ceiling. So you know what? It might take us a little longer, but this is important.
He, in other words, was saying, no, I think Republicans have a majority here. This will take a little longer. What does that mean? I asked Rosa DeLauro, who is the ranking Democrat on the Appropriations Committee, and this is how I also think of this. To do what the Republicans are trying to do with these appropriations bills, get the whole thing through, minimum of 6 weeks. So think of what's going on here right now as this. I know you've covered hurricanes before. Think of the shutdown as a coming hurricane. We know it's coming. Republicans, instead of moving to a known shelter, instead of getting out of the way of the hurricane, they're trying to just start building a new house from scratch. In other words, everyone is getting ready for a shutdown. They're sort of leaning into the shutdown unless something dramatic changes, really by a legislative miracle next week.
Really incredible metaphor. third development that is happening this week. There was action on something. The Senate was able to confirm a few military leaders. This circumvents the block that we have seen that Senator Tuberville has been holding up on this. How did that happen? What does that mean?
Right. This was significant. These are major military posts, two of which have been open for weeks and sometimes months. Let's look at exactly who was confirmed this week so people understand the gravity here. Look at this. Nothing less than the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff nominee, the Army Chief of Staff, the Commandant of the Marine Corps. Those two offices there on the right have been open, filled in acting ways until these confirmations this week. These are the top military officers waiting for a single senator to allow them to proceed. It's significant, but what happened is Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, essentially moved around the block of Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama. It's not a long-term breakthrough, to be honest. Tuberville, as we've discussed on this program before, is holding up these hundreds of military nominations because he objects to the military's policy, helping to fund abortion and reproductive travel for people who are in the military and unable to get that care where they live. Now, what's going on now? Tuberville still says he is not going to allow these larger blocks of military nominations to move. He is still daring Chuck Schumer to do them like he did this week, one by one by one. But I will tell you, Tuberville did allow these nominations to move a little bit more quickly than he could have. That's very kind of Senate process thing, but it was notable. It was the first crack that we've seen. I know from behind the scenes, Republicans are telling him, it's time to end this. This is a problem. And I know in the military, it also is something we hear a lot about from those colonels and all of those levels that are waiting for their promotions and waiting to take command.
Lisa Desjardins, as always, thank you so much for getting us through all this.
You're welcome.
In the day's other headlines, Tropical Storm Ophelia is barreling towards the East Coast, raising the risk of flooding and tornadoes. It's expected to strengthen before making landfall Saturday morning in North Carolina and then moving north through the mid-Atlantic. Authorities are warning of life-threatening storm surge and dangerous rip currents. A judge at Guantanamo Bay has declared one of the defendants in the 9/11 attacks case unfit for trial. A military medical panel found that years of CIA torture has rendered Ramzi bin al-Shib lastingly psychotic. The prosecution will continue for the other four co-defendants. No trial date has been set. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is close to a historic peace agreement with Saudi Arabia. It would be the fifth Arab nation to normalize ties with Israel since the signing of the so-called Abraham Accords in 2020. Netanyahu made the announcement at the UN General Assembly today, where he spoke optimistically about the future of the region.
Today I bring this marker to show a great blessing, the blessing of a new Middle East between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and our other neighbors. We will not only bring down barriers between Israel and our neighbors, we'll build a new corridor of peace and prosperity.
There are still several obstacles to the agreement that Israel has not publicly addressed, including Saudi Arabia's demand for progress creating a Palestinian state. Russia's defense ministry said Armenian forces in the breakaway Nagorno-Karabakh region have started handing over their weapons to Russian peacekeepers. There have been several ceasefire violations, but no deaths since Azerbaijan recaptured the region this week. Meanwhile, in Armenia, protests erupted in the capital of Yerevan. Dozens of demonstrators were arrested after demanding their prime minister step down over the offensive. Pope Francis is denouncing what he calls the, quote, fanaticism of indifference that greets migrants who are searching for a better life in Europe. He did so while visiting in France, visiting the Mediterranean port of Marseille amid a huge influx of migrants from Africa. The pontiff spoke at a memorial to migrants and sailors lost at sea.
Before us is the sea, a source of life, yet this place evokes the tragedy of shipwrecks, which cause death. Let us not get used to seeing disasters at sea as mere news stories and those dying at sea as numbers. No, they are names and surnames. They are faces and stories. They are broken lives and shattered dreams.
The Pope's visit comes days after nearly 7,000 migrants overwhelmed the small Italian island of Lampedusa in just one day. And Wall Street wrapped up its worst week in 6 months by adding to its losses. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slid 106 points to close at 33,964. The Nasdaq fell 12 points. The S&P 500 slipped 10. Still to come on the NewsHour, the White House announces the first ever federal office of gun violence prevention. New ethics allegations are brought against Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines. And the husband and wife duo behind the blues rock Tedeschi Truck Band reflect on their career.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
President Biden today announced the creation of the first ever federal office of gun violence prevention. It aims to curb the epidemic of firearm violence in America. So far this year, there have been more than 500 mass shootings in this country, and some 25,000 people have died because of guns. That's roughly 118 deaths per day, according to the Gun Violence Archive. The president said that toll was far too high.
I determined to send a clear message about how important this issue is to me and to the country. After every mass shooting, we hear a simple message, the same message heard all over the country, and I've been to every mass shooting. Do something. Well, my administration has been working relentlessly to do something.
Our White House correspondent, Laura Barrón-López, joins us now to break down what we can expect from this new office. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
The number of dead from guns in America is just horrendous. What is this new office hoping, intending to do?
This new office is going to be a central hub, essentially, for enforcement, coordination, public outreach. As you well know, William, last year, the president signed into law a bill, a bipartisan bill, that cracked down on background checks, essentially trying to enhance background checks. And so they're going to be coordinating aggressively with states to make sure that that's enforced. There's also billions of dollars that were allocated in that bill to tackle gun violence prevention, mental health, school safety. And so a lot of the people I've spoken to, including the White House, say that this office is going to make sure that all of that is enforced and implemented, that those communities realize that there's that money there for them to use.
And Vice President Kamala Harris is going to oversee this.
That's correct. So Harris is going to oversee this. There's going to be a specific director that is also named. And they brought in two people who had worked for a long time as gun safety advocates on the legal side, as community organizers, also into this office. But Harris, the vice president, brings a lot of visibility to it that necessarily would not have been there if they had just appointed other civil servants or brought in lower level people. And so this is a part of her larger effort to really reach young voters and to show that the administration is focused on this issue.
I mean, as you well know, gun violence prevention experts have been arguing that there needs to be a federal office like this for years. So why is the White House doing this now?
The gun safety advocates that I was talking to today said that as recently as March, the White House was not going to appoint any director of or create this new office at all, but that they feel as though because the election is around the corner and because of the very public campaign that they waged to get the White House to do this, that essentially the president, the vice president came around because they've been talking to a lot of voters. Now, one thing, I did speak to Poe Murray of the Newtown Alliance and executive director there, and she said that she really wants to make sure that this new office talks much more frequently to survivors of gun violence, to young people who have experienced it in some way, as well as also making sure that law enforcement is doing what they need to do to crack down on guns.
So the White House and Democrats also think this is an electoral strategy?
They do. The White House very much sees guns as one of the big defining issues heading into the 2024 election cycle. And I spoke to Senator Chris Murphy today of Connecticut. As you know, that's where the Sandy Hook mass shooting took place. And he told me that my party got it wrong for 20 years. After 1994, Democrats stopped talking about guns and gun laws, and that was a huge mistake. You can't win in the suburbs or the cities if you have no answers to the gun violence mass shooting epidemic. And other sources that I spoke to told me that internal Democratic Party polling shows that guns is the second top issue for young voters, right behind student debt.
You mentioned some of this before. Where does this effort fit in with President Biden's other efforts on guns?
There was the big crackdown on ghost guns, which are those kits that are sold online that don't have serial numbers or background checks, but that regulation that is currently in place change that. Biden pushed for that, as well as right now, just around the corner, the Justice Department regulation is likely soon to be finalized. And what that does is expand who actually is defined as a firearms dealer. And so, in effect, once that is actually finalized, it would also expand background checks. Now, the one thing that Democrats and a number of gun advocates still want to see from the administration is they think there could be executive actions on changing who has oversight of the export of firearms from Commerce Department, which is where it currently is, over to the State Department. They want to see that happen. They also think that the Defense Department could issue a rule, essentially, or issue a memo, essentially saying that they will only that they only want to buy firearms from manufacturers that sell to the military and not to civilians.
Laura Barrón López, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For years, the influential Koch Network, the conservative political organization founded by billionaires Charles and David Koch, has held a fundraiser in Palm Springs. It attracts wealthy conservative donors from around the country. In 2018, Justice Clarence Thomas attended this fundraiser, one of several he allegedly attended over the years. That's according to another new investigation by ProPublica. Like their previous reports, this raises serious questions over Justice Thomas's undisclosed connections to powerful people who have brought cases before the Supreme Court, including one of the most watched cases in the court's upcoming term. We are joined now by one of the reporters who helped break this story, ProPublica's Joshua Kaplan. Joshua, very good to have you back on the NewsHour. Before we get to Thomas and his role here, can you just tell us a little bit more about the Koch Network and its aims?
So the Koch Network was founded by billionaire industrialists Charles and David Koch to push America toward their libertarian vision for the country. And it's one of the most powerful and influential political groups of the last half century. So to name a couple things, they helped cultivate the Tea Party movement in the Obama years. They're credited for helping stamp out GOP support for combating climate change. And behind that influence is a huge fundraising operation. And the marquee fundraising event is this annual donor summit that they have out in Palm Springs, which is what Thomas attended. To score an invite to that event, donors have to give at least $100,000 a year, and many give a lot more than that.
So you report in your new investigation that Justice Thomas flew on a private jet to this fundraiser. He didn't disclose that. We don't know who paid for that jet. But beyond that, what else is the conflict here for the justice? Are there members of the Koch Network who had business before the court?
Yes. So they've had multiple cases at the Supreme Court. It's a pretty extraordinary position he's been in, having served as a fundraising draw for this network. I mean, and it's also, judges sit in a unique position of public trust. The judiciary has very lofty ethics rules to govern, to protect their independence and impartiality. There's political activity is banned, for instance. So is participation in fundraising. We talked to one former federal judge appointed by George Bush, who told us that he couldn't imagine Thomas would think it was appropriate to go to a Koch donor summit, that it took his breath away. He said that if he had done the same thing when he was a lower court judge, he'd have gotten a letter starting a disciplinary process. But those ethics rules only apply to the lower courts. At the Supreme Court, the justices decide what's appropriate for themselves.
There was a spokesperson for Koch's group, which is known as Stand Together. They were cited in your report, and they sent us a similar statement. And their statement said, in part, quote, "There is a long tradition of public officials, including Supreme Court justices, sharing their experiences, ideas, and judicial philosophy with members of the public at dinners and other events. Our events are no different." How accurate is that? Is there a distinction to be made here?
Yes. I mean, I think there is a distinction to be made. This is a political organization. And it is also, I mean, like I said, I mean, this to other judges we talked to, this was shocking. And yes, as they said, you know, many justices and judges give speeches, they go on book tours. But I'm not sure. I mean, certainly the experts we talked to, the judges we talked to, the judiciary's rules itself, consider that very different than attending an event for political donors.
We heard today that, again, similar calls coming out of Congress that your reporting has further sort of incensed the Democratic Party in particular, saying that there needs to be any reform. Do you have any sense that the Supreme Court will change its ethics guidelines or that Congress or the Senate will do anything about this?
I mean, for the Supreme Court, it's hard to say from the outside. But, you know, John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh have both said that they, you know, hope the court will take concrete steps at some point in the near future. I mean, it's, you know, members of the court have been publicly saying that the court will adopt a code of ethics for 4 or 5 years now, at least, and it hasn't happened yet. And I think there's, you know, potentially challenges with, you know, do they need unanimity, and how does one get that consensus? In terms of Congress, there's a bill that has been advanced out of the Senate Judiciary Committee that would require the Supreme Court to adopt a code of conduct and also implement some other, a couple other ethics rules. That so far is not going nowhere. I believe, Senator Schumer has said that, you know, he thinks it would be filibustered, and so he's not advancing it to the floor.
All right, Joshua Kaplan of ProPublica, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
One day after visiting Washington, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met today with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. And Ukraine claimed responsibility for another attack in Russian-occupied Crimea, hitting the headquarters of Russia's Black Sea Naval Fleet. Today, Nick Schifrin sat down with Ukraine's National Security Advisor in Kyiv to discuss the possibility that Congress will not approve a vital aid package and the course of Ukraine's counteroffensive to free Russian-occupied territory.
Outside Bakhmut, Ukrainian soldiers advance through a moonscape. They won this battle for what was once the village of Andriivka. And in the last few days in southern Ukraine, they pushed through some Russian defenses. But the counteroffensive's cost and challenge are great, says Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council Secretary Oleksiy Danilov.
How do you think the counteroffensive is going?
Складно, важко.
Difficult, hard. But every day we're inching forward. What I mean is that, unfortunately, it is not only up to us when it comes to the fighting. A lot depends on other factors, which, unfortunately, we have no control over.
Mr. President, it's an honor to welcome back to the White House.
That's a reference to Ukraine's partners, particularly the United States. President Volodymyr Zelensky received a warm welcome yesterday at the White House, but he also walked through a Congress fighting over the administration's next Ukraine aid package. Danilov says the problem runs deeper.
You see, the West has not come to a consensus on what would be Ukrainian victory. They talk about assistance, but not about victory. These are two different things. If we did not have victory, then the very existence of our country and the war that our children and grandchildren would have to fight is only a matter of time. That's why we need victory.
Yesterday, President Zelensky told senators, if we do not get the next U.S. aid package, we will lose the war. Can you explain that? Why would you lose the war if you don't get the next U.S. aid package?
Keep in mind that it is very painful for him to review reports that we receive every morning on how many of our boys and girls have died. And if we had had the capabilities to end this war as quickly as possible, I mean military capabilities, they would still be alive.
But what did he mean?
It means we need help.
So far, the U.S. has sent weapons, vehicles, and ammunition worth more than $46 billion. Danilov suggested if the American well runs dry, there's no backup.
What are you doing to prepare for the possibility of not having as many American weapon systems and ammunition as you've been using? Is there a plan B?
We cannot say that we have some sort of separate discussions about some plan B. We have no desire to engage in some sidetracked discussions.
Yesterday, after an expanded meeting with Zelensky's team, President Biden went even further.
I'm counting on a good judgment of the United States Congress. There's no alternative.
Danilov showed me an interactive map that tracks historic Russian airstrikes and today's front line in the most critical direction toward Crimea.
Are you trying to move farther down in this area to be able to threaten Russian supply lines?
It's very simple. We have to go to the sea.
Today, a Ukrainian cruise missile struck Russia's Black Sea Navy headquarters in Sevastopol, Crimea. Ukraine appears to have increased its attacks in occupied Crimea, including on Russian warships last week.
Well, starting from February 24th, 2022, we're constantly trying to destroy the military potential in the temporarily occupied territory of our Crimea. Several times we have struck the so-called illegal Crimean Bridge, which is the military gateway for the Russian Federation. We have achieved results in attacking Russian warships that fire missiles into our territory.
And Ukraine has also increased attacks deep inside Russia, including the Chkalovsky Air Base that hosts specialist military aircraft and VIP transport planes.
These airfields house support planes for missile launch jets that fire rockets into our cities. So why should we not destroy them? We've been attacking them, and we will keep doing that until Putin withdraws all his troops from our territory.
As for the counteroffensive, the days ahead might be dark, but Danilov remains determined.
Sooner or later, it will end, and I am more than sure that we will win. And it will be a happy ending for our country. It cannot be otherwise, because if the darkness keeps winning, rest assured that in that case, our country will be first, and yours will be next.
National Security Advisor Danilov, thank you very much.
Washington is bracing for busy days ahead as the deadline for a government shutdown quickly approaches. To discuss that and more, we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Gentlemen, welcome. So nice to see you.
Good to see you.
David, Congress has left for the long weekend. I guess they think it's a good time to take a break. But we are awfully close to this government shutdown. How close do you think we really are?
Quite close. Well, in time terms, it's basically a week. In probability terms, there's a very high probability the government will shut down and will be where we've been before. And the core cause is that there are a group of members of Congress who are not interested in practical governance. They're right that our deficits are too big on the far right of the Republican Party, but they have no strategy to get there. And so they're basically a bunch of nihilistic performance artists. And
that looks great on a business card.
Yeah, that was my nickname in high school. So Speaker McCarthy has to decide what to do. And the core simple truth should be, well, we don't allow performance artists to have power. And he's giving them a lot of power because he's refusing to or is unable or unwilling to cut a deal with the Democrats and sort of freeze out the people on the right. And in my view, he should take them on right now, because his power will wane, and that his fear is he'll lose his job as Speaker. But if he wants to keep that Speaker job, he'll be weaker in 2 weeks, he'll be weaker in 3 weeks when everyone's upset about a government shutdown than he is right now. And so, in my view, he should take them on right now and try to cut some sort of deal, or stick to the deal he cut with Joe Biden, actually.
I mean, David is describing the idea that McCarthy still has some agency in all of this, but it seems like in the last few weeks and days, it seems like he's utterly lost control of his own caucus.
I mean, that's assuming he had any control to begin with. Let's not forget, and it's now a mantra, it took 15 ballots for him to get the Speaker's gavel to begin with. But I agree with David. The Speaker needs to exert some control. He has a five-seat majority. Get it. Totally understand it. Speaker Pelosi also had a similar majority, and she got a lot done. And why? Because she exercised the power of the office. Speaker McCarthy absolutely should tell this rump faction within his majority to go stuff it. I have governing to do. We have governing to do. We can't allow the government to shut down. And this is the fork in the road that the Speaker is facing. Unfortunately, I have no confidence that the Speaker won't choose holding on to the gavel versus showing real governance, passing a CR, getting these budget bills passed. He's going to keep that Speaker's gavel at all costs, and we'll pay for it.
David, you mentioned this idea that the Republicans feel like they have to now reach out to the Democrats to try to get this done. Do you think the Democrats will do that, and at what price might they want to extract from him?
Well, I think the price they should ask for is we already did this deal. Like, the Joe Biden and McCarthy did this deal, and so that's our price. Let's just stick to the deal. And the problem for McCarthy is there are a lot of people, probably more than just the fringe in his party, who really do care about spending, and so they want something with less spending than the deal that Biden cut. To me, that's probably a political non-starter. And they've got to get serious. If you really want to cut spending, well, let's throw everything on the table. Let's throw tax hikes on the table. Let's throw entitlements on the table. Let's throw defense on the table. But thinking you can make some big spending reduction just with this, what they call non-defense discretionary spending, that's just crowd cuckoo land. So they're just not serious. I sympathize with the idea that our deficits are too big, but they're just not serious.
Jonathan, do you think the Democrats, in offering this potential, that they want to see McCarthy twist in the wind more than they want to see the government shut down?
Well, both are happening. I mean, he's twisting in the wind right now, and I firmly believe, as I sit here right now, that the government is going to shut down. And it's going to shut down because Speaker McCarthy is going to be unwilling to work with Democrats. There is an easy solution to this. Work with Democrats, come up with a bill, and then have that bill pass out of the House by huge numbers, thereby sending a signal to the Senate, but also to the rest of the country, that you know how to do the job you are entrusted with.
I want to turn to Ukraine. We saw President Zelensky here again pleading with America's leaders to come forward with more aid. And he's arguing basically that this war hinges on our morale, which he says they have in plenty of supply, but Western aid. And we saw that he really got a frosty reaction from Republicans. McCarthy wouldn't even have his picture taken with him. Is this skepticism within the GOP really growing?
Tremendously, yeah. I mean, if you had told me a year ago that the Ukrainians would be like totally still in it and they're the ones who are actually suffering, and that Western Europe would be strongly supportive, no wavering there, and that the wavering would be in the US and in the Republican Party, I probably wouldn't believe that, but that's exactly where it is. There's always been a rump of people in the party who just don't want military, don't want support. They don't think Ukraine's a strategic country. They have their reasons. That number is maybe doubling, maybe going up by 50%. Nobody knows exactly, but it's significantly eroding. And so that's happening. And at the same time, on the Democratic side, there's a big and I think important debate. Should we admit Ukraine into NATO? And the hope is that if we admit them into Ukraine into NATO, Putin will not want to attack a NATO country, and that will prevent a forever war. And so the two parties are going in very different directions, where the Republicans are just walking away, and some Democrats are saying, no, we need to get more involved in Ukraine politically and give them this alliance so they can stand up to Putin.
How do you see that unfolding?
Well, one, I want to go back to the idea that the Speaker of the House would not even allow himself to be photographed with a wartime president. And what I find so...
What do you attribute that to?
Fear of the far right in his caucus that are clamoring for defunding Ukraine, along with a lot of other things that they want to do. That's what I think that's about. It goes back to the shutdown. But the other thing that why I find that move so galling, as Speaker, he is number three in line to the presidency, which automatically makes him a statesman. And so you have a wartime president coming to this country begging for our help and our continued support, and he won't even show him that. I mean, thankfully, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Majority Leader Schumer and the president showed him America's resolve. But I'm with David. I am astounded. I'm old enough to remember when the Republican Party was about standing with allies, bolstering the Western alliance, and particularly a country where the battle is between democracy and autocracy, and if they lose, then the whole enterprise, the whole experiment that is democracy would be on its last leg.
I mean, do you see it that way as well? Do you think that, as Jonathan is describing, that the graybeard, so to speak, in the Republican Party will prevail and keep America funding?
I think so. But if you're Vladimir Putin, you're looking at this and thinking, I'm going to keep fighting because they're weakening over there. And then I'm thinking, well, I'm definitely going to keep fighting till November of 2024, because his best hope of victory is not anything that happens on the battlefield in Ukraine. It's Donald Trump getting elected, in which case he's going to do very well in this war. And we should say, in both these issues tonight, the budget deal and in Ukraine, Donald Trump is the four-time indicted elephant in the room. And he's been saying, don't cut a deal. And he's been saying, we got to get out of Ukraine. And the rest of the Republicans are looking at him.
David, before we go, I want to ask you about this tweet that you put out this week where, and we can put this up on screen, you posted this tweet that showed a dinner that you were having at an airport and that it cost $78. And you wrote, this is why the American people think the economy is terrible. You got roughed up a little bit online about this, but I'm just curious more about what you were trying to convey with that.
Yeah, well, first it started out hatched in my mind as a joke, because if you looked at what I was eating, it was bourbon and a very fattening hamburger and fries. So it's
delicious,
like
dinner.
I can't afford to make bad lifestyle choices. But the problem with the tweet, which I wrote so stupidly, was that it made it seem like I was oblivious to something that is blindingly obvious, that an upper middle class journalist having a bourbon at an airport is a lot different than a family living paycheck to paycheck. And when I'm getting sticker shock, it's like an inconvenience. When they're getting sticker shock, it's a disaster. And so I was insensitive. I screwed up. I should not have written that tweet. I probably should not write any tweets. But
We should all be taking.
But I made a mistake, and it was stupid. But the one point that is maybe can be drawn, if anything can be drawn, was you can experience inflation as a chart with downward slope, inflation's coming down. But the way we experience relaxation day to day is as that moment of sticker shock. You're in the grocery store, you're at the gas station, and suddenly costs something way more than you anticipated. And for people who are less fortunate than I am, that is a disaster. And so we have to understand why we say inflation's coming down, but for people living and seeing those sticker shock moments, it doesn't feel that way.
David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, so nice to see you both. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Thanks, William. Thank you.
While the pandemic caused heartbreak for millions, it also provided a chance for some artists to reset. I recently spent time with the musicians behind the Tedeschi Trucks Band, who credit their time in lockdown, plus a centuries-old poem, with not only opening new creative paths, but with fusing their band even more tightly. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas. In the world of musical marriages, there's none quite like this one. Susan Tedeschi's and Derek Trucks. As the creative duo behind the 12-member Tedeschi Trucks band, this husband and wife have been called two of the best roots musicians of their generation. But before joining together musically, they each had successful solo careers.
Oh, I'm feeling kinda lonely.
Susan's first major label record, Just Won't Burn, now being reissued for its 25th anniversary, went gold, rare for a debut blues album. With her soulful voice and guitar, she got 5 Grammy nominations and toured with some of the greats, Buddy Guy, B.B. King, Bob Dylan, and the Rolling Stones. Derek is considered one of the greatest living blues guitarists. He began touring at age 12. A sneaker-clad prodigy talented enough to take on Eric Clapton's Layla. At 20, he joined the legendary Allman Brothers and played with them for over a decade. His blend of blues, jazz, and Indian styles made him the youngest player named to Rolling Stone's list of the 100 greatest guitarists, at number 16.
And this up here, there's an osprey nest.
So after years of passing each other on the road, these two solo artists met, fell in love, and started a life together.
Having a bit of a crash, so Sue calls. Yeah, we did it all out of order. It was pregnancy, marriage.
Well, we bought the house first.
House.
We bought the house
pregnancy,
first.
Pregnancy, marriage.
Then we got
pregnant.
And
then pregnant. About 10 years in, you're
then
like,
then we got married.
I think we're ready to put a band together.
Then like, we did a band.
We need to be married for 10
that
years.
That is really a scrambled set of sequence.
Yeah. Well, you do what you can because, you know, we weren't, you know, we don't have a normal life schedule.
Their 2010 debut, Revelator, went gold, won the Grammy for Best Blues Record, and launched a new chapter. Their band, including horns, double drummers, and keyboards, recorded a string of records and spent 10 long years touring the globe. By any measure, they were a success, but it was draining. Then, when beloved band member Kofi Burbridge died of a heart condition, a man Trucks called the beating heart of the band, they began to reassess.
The main story we are following, and that is the coronavirus pandemic.
And then came the pandemic and subsequent lockdown that brought life to a standstill.
For us, in a lot of ways, the pandemic kind of saved our band. Like, we were really at a point of, we were about to take time off to kind of
deal with the loss,
to deal
of, Kofi.
With the loss of Kofi, and just
and
kind of
JJ
reset and think
right
about what do we want to do
February.
And what is this thing. And it was a hard reset for us.
Longtime band member Mike Madison says it was a rough period.
The tank was pretty low. I mean, we had been touring pretty hard for over a decade, and we had achieved what we wanted to achieve. But I think what we realized in going down this wormhole is that we hadn't said what we wanted to say.
So Madison had an idea. During lockdown, everyone in the band would read the 12th century Persian poem, Layla and Majnun. It's an Arab Romeo and Juliet story about two lovers held apart by a male-dominated society. Heartbroken Majnun wanders the wilderness going mad. Layla gets locked in a tower and forced to marry another man. That poem inspired Eric Clapton's Derek and the Dominoes record, Layla, a record that the Tedeschi Trucks Band had recently recorded live. But Madison wanted to go back to the centuries-old source, all 258 pages of it.
The thing I was most concerned about is that I would be just shunned for being a nerd. That, oh gee, now we have homework. You know?
Exactly.
Mike's original thought was, let's just all read this poem and then just flip the perspective instead of, like, the Layla album is just this lovesick man that can't have this thing he desires. And his was, what did she think about this? Like, what was her perspective? And we're like, well, that's perfect.
So mid-pandemic, the band gathered at Tedeschi and Trucks' home and studio and began writing. An enormous number of songs poured out. Multiple band members contributed ideas.
Out here, hanging on the street.
Some, but not all, touched on themes from the poem.
Home so tight, I feel everything.
I like when music comes like that.
It sounds like a pretty beautiful experience.
Yeah, because you really don't have any control over it. It's more like if the muse is there that day and it just pours out of you and you're in the moment where you can be receptive and write it down or feel it or play off of, you know, your bandmates or whatever.
Yeah. Did you have any reluctance or hesitancy to looking at a book that was principally about the man and the woman at the center of this story that's basically you guys and have everybody in the group reading about this central relationship?
There's a little bit of that. There were times songs would come in and I'm like,
that's a little on the nose.
Yeah, wait a minute. But, you know, one of the big takeaways from me in reading that story was, and Mike alludes to this in a few of the tunes he wrote, is when you're in a relationship, the what's going on doesn't just affect the two people in the relationship. Like, it can really spill out in positive ways or negative ways.
And
we see in our situation that's absolutely true.
It's not just about a guy in the wilderness pining, you know. There's so much more going on. And in the poem, you hear from Layla, and she has very specific things to say about how she feels about this guy. And not all of them are great. And also her treatment at the hands of her father and the world. Yeah, and I think she definitely picked up on that. I think a lot of that very much resonated with her, especially being in the business she's in and the genre that we do.
I see, as a woman, and all the things going on in the world as a woman, and women really trying to stand up and have a voice in a different way now, even though women are more vocal, that doesn't mean our rights are more equal, you know? So it's kind of interesting. There's a lot of things that really haven't changed. I mean, obviously in America, we're much better off, but there are plenty of countries in the world that are just like that.
It was a remarkably fruitful period. The band recorded 4 albums and released them sequentially. I Am the Moon, volumes 1-4, each with accompanying films by director Alex Lambert. The Tedeschi Trucks Band continues their tour, a community on stage, 12 members strong. They're playing music inspired by a centuries-old poem, but in this telling, the star-crossed couple made it, and the woman's not locked away in a tower, but commands center stage. Later this evening on PBS, American Masters presents a film about legendary attorney Floyd Abrams. The documentary focuses on the groundbreaking career of the First Amendment lawyer who helped define free speech as it is known today. Floyd Abrams, Speaking Freely, premieres tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. Check your local listings. And for more on the Republican infighting and the looming government shutdown, don't forget to watch Jeffrey Goldberg and his panel tonight on Washington Week with The Atlantic. And tomorrow on PBS News Weekend, driverless taxis, are they the way of the future or a dangerous venture? That is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm William Brangham. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us. Good night.